The InStyleOwen podcast is brought to you by Cybionics, an emerging CGM brand that focuses on simplifying how individuals aged 18 and above monitor and control their blood sugar levels. Upon becoming available on the market, the Cybionics GS1 CGM has helped users worldwide navigate the complexities of diabetes management with more confidence and peace of mind. Thanks to Cybionics, now more people are able to view and share their real-time glucose data, receive customizable glucose alarms, and generate full AGP reports, all directly from an intuitive Cybionics app, empowering them with the necessary information to make better decisions about their health. Cybionics combines data accuracy and comfort of wear, which is important to us all, with a feature-rich app. The 14-day scanning-free and calibration-free Cybionics GS1 CGM aims to deliver reliable, seamless diabetes management experiences. For more, check out cybionicscgm.com. This is the InStyleOwen podcast, where I, Owen Costello, try to redefine diabetes. In this week's episode...
When I go low, my brain's just like, you can do this, you'll be fine, even though clearly not. It's taken me years to work out, no, shut up. You know, when you have to tell your own brain to shut up. And I think in the middle of being on stage, when my mind's already on lots of material, it was just like, power through it, you'll be fine. And of course, I'd come on stage and check and go, oh, I'm a two. Oh, no.
But before we get into that, everything you hear on the InStyleOwen podcast is from my own personal experience. And if you have any worries or issues regarding your diabetes, please contact a medical professional. Now, let's get stuck into this episode.
How's it going? Welcome back to the InStyleOwen podcast. I hope you're well. I hope the week is going well for you so far. And today I am chatting with Mr. Tiernan Duyeb. And I had to make sure that I was pronouncing that correctly because it's a very unusual spelling. But today with Tiernan was a fascinating conversation and a very different type of conversation that we would typically have on the podcast, which I really, really enjoyed. But Tiernan was diagnosed at the age of 4, and he's been living with type 1 diabetes for nearly 4 decades and speaks about his experience with the condition up to this point. Tiernan has spent 20 plus years traveling on the road as a comedian, opening for some of the biggest stand-up comics in the industry like Frankie Boyle, but in the last 2 years and following the pandemic shutting down comedy for a while, he moved over to writing for TV instead. Tiernan now writes for kids TV on shows such as Hey Dougie. He outlines how his lifestyle has changed from driving around the country doing late night shows to a more of a kind of 9-to-5 writing from home schedule. In this episode, Tiernan speaks about growing up with type 1 diabetes since the age of 4, as I said, how it has shaped his funnier perspective on life, how he manages life as a dad with type 1 diabetes, what life looked like on the road as a comedian for 20 plus years, why diabetes has become an integral part of his life, and much, much more. Naturally, you're going to laugh a good bit during this episode because Tiernan is a comedian. So please enjoy the episode and I'll chat to you soon.
I actually watched, Tiernan, was the talk that you did at Talking About Diabetes, the conference, or talk about
diabetes? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's my 15 minutes. It's only about diabetes set. Yeah.
I watched that yesterday in preparation for this podcast. It was hilarious. But
thank you.
What was that even like for you? Was that the first time that you've spoken as publicly as you did about your diabetes? Or
yeah, I think that's the most I've ever said about diabetes. For some years I had jokes about being diabetic, and they were quite basic ones, and I just little sort of, you know, about me being type 1. I've always had a joke about the fact that you know, I've never treated diabetes too seriously when the worst conditions can be fixed with a biscuit. And I've always sort of had a joke about that. But I never went into it as much as I did with that conversation, which is, I think, partly because there's an absolutely brilliant comedian called Ed Gamble, who's more famous than me. I love Ed to bits, but he's more famous and he's now the diabetic comedian. So damn you, Ed. I leave it to him. But also because I don't want it to define me on... I didn't want it to define me on stage. And I think I got quite bored of talking solidly about myself. So when I was doing gigs, I much preferred talking about the world and other things. And if diabetes came into it, then it did. But otherwise, I'd leave it out. But that talk was 15 minutes of solid type one material, which was actually really, it was really good to get it off my chest, actually.
Yeah. How did you, I suppose I have massive respect for anybody who can stand up on stage and speak, but also I have even more respect for somebody who can stand up on stage and actively make people laugh, because it's a very difficult thing to do. So even with that speech specifically or that talk, how do you start something like that? What does the process usually look like, or how did you go about it?
That's a very good question. I mean, you've got to make it true to yourself. That sounds like a very corny statement to make, doesn't it? But it's got to be like, what do I find funny about diabetes? Because if I didn't find it funny, no one else in that room is going to find it funny. I had to find all the points about it I'm sure this is something we'll get into, but diabetes is serious and it is a condition we have to live with, but I find it very funny. I find there's lots of aspects of it that are very funny. And I talked about one of them in the set, that I've got the pump and it's got a very strong plastic cable. And genuinely, the amount of times I've got that caught on a door handle as I'm about to leave a room and I get twanged back in. And sure, medically, not great. In life, physical comedy, that is hilarious. Every single time my wife absolutely loses it and I find it hilarious. So, you know, I had to include bits like that. I have to include the lighter side of it that I laugh about every day. And as we deal with it every day, you know, all these things kind of innately. So that was the kind of angle I chose. And I think I went for I wanted to be positive about it. I didn't want to do 15 minutes of, isn't this terrible? I wanted to do 15 minutes about, do you know what? This isn't the worst thing we could have. We all manage it. We can deal with it. And I wanted to do it with that kind of voice, which was a nice place to start from. And then that kind of helped me write the whole set from there.
It's definitely a different type of perspective that a lot of people with type 1 would have. Because as you say, and you touched on it briefly, diabetes is obviously a very serious condition. But being able to look at it on the lighter note, or the lighter side, or the more funny type of side, as you've said, can inevitably make it easier to manage on a daily basis, because the reality of it is we're living with it for a long time, as you know, more than I do, being 39 years diagnosed. And I think the balance of saying, yeah, it is obviously serious, but you need to have a laugh about it every now and then, kind of takes the severity away from it to a certain extent. Is that a way you have always felt about it? Because I was listening to you say that when you were first diagnosed as a 4-year-old, I think it was three nurses were physically holding you down to put a needle in your arm or something. Like, did you always have that type of perspective, or can you even remember how you felt about it back then?
It's tricky actually, because I think I have that perspective on a lot of life. I always feel like you have to laugh about everything, or you have to, you know, even though with my stand-up, I've always been quite a friendly and a nice comedian, I think when things are really grim, I have to make jokes about it, because it's my kind of coping, that you have to find the funny through it, to laugh about it and deal. It's a way that you deal with it and process it. But with diabetes, I think in a way, having, how old were you when you got diagnosed? Were you a teenager?
19,
right. So I think, not that it's easy getting it at any point, but getting it aged 4, I don't remember a life without it. So I don't remember what it was like being 4. I've been told the anecdote about the nurses. So in my head, I was a super strong, like Hulk, like 4-year-old. Take that, 3 nurses. Yeah, fight me. But, you know, it wasn't them. I don't remember it. I've got a horrible, vivid memory of when they put the needle in the vein in the back of the wrist. I think there's a 4-year-old. I don't know if they still do that. I'm sure they've got nicer methods. But when they took my blood, that the only vein big enough was the one back of my wrist. And I think at age 4, that's like a nightmare. That was like, I remember the horror of that. But I don't really remember having to deal with it. I'll tell you actually something that my Nana, who is 99 this year, which is incredible. Wow. Nothing to do with this podcast. I just have to tell everyone that.
That's insane.
Amazing. She's incredible. Still like savvy sense of humor. She's amazing. But she was telling me the other day about when I was 4 or 5 and she was looking after me and I'd not long been diagnosed. And she was very worried about injecting me. And I went straight up to her and I went, Nana, it's time for my injection. Inject me. And she went, what? And I pulled my trousers down, stuck my bum out. And I went, right there, do it there now. And she was like, and I just had to give you your injection. And you were just on it. So, you know, clearly age four, you just sort of, you just kind of get on with it because you're four and you don't know how the world works. And it's not, it's not scary because you haven't thought that far ahead in your life yet. So I think in a way that, it's, yeah, as I say, it's not lucky. That's maybe the wrong word, but getting it that young meant that I didn't have it. It hadn't changed my life because I hadn't really had a life yet. You know?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and like with almost any guest that we have on this podcast, there's always a debate around like, is it better to be diagnosed when you're older, or is it better to be diagnosed when you're younger? And obviously, there's quote unquote pros and cons for both to a certain extent. I've spoken to people who are diagnosed your age or around your age, and a lot of them are like, would say something similar along the lines of, well, I couldn't imagine life without it. Therefore, I can't compare my life as a diabetic compared to not being a diabetic. But very rarely, I don't think I've ever heard that type of positive perspective from somebody even at that age. Why do you feel you kind of had that innate positive reaction to it, that kind of like just deal with it type of attitude?
I don't know. That's funny, isn't it? I don't know. Like I said, I think that's partly just me. I think it's also, you know, I didn't know any other diabetics that age. It was probably in a very shallow sense. It was probably something that was interesting about me in that age. It was probably something, you know, at school. I can't remember if I talked about this in that TAD talk, but I had to always go to the welfare room every day at 10 a.m. and have a biscuit and do my blood test. And all the other kids were like, what? Why do you get to do that? You know, they were. I was the special kid. I got to go eat a little biscuit and didn't do maths, you know. And that's a little thing you got to be proud of. You think that's what makes me a bit different and a bit more interesting. And I think I kind of just went with that aspect. You know, but I think also I'm just... I say I'm a positive. I think the more and more I collapse into my 40s, I'm less positive. But generally in life, I kind of go, you know, there's a way out of this. There's a way through this. We just got to kind of laugh about it and get on.
Yeah. How did you originally start getting into comedy? Because obviously you were a stand-up comic for 20 plus years. How did you, or when did you know that this was an avenue you wanted to start going down?
I didn't for ages. I slightly cheated, and I'll always say it's cheating, really. But I always wanted to do acting. I really wanted to be on stage, and I'd done loads of school performances and amateur theatre bits. I was just really keen to be on stage, being very loud as often as possible, probably annoyingly so many times. And then when I was at university, I did a drama course. And one of the options on the course was to do stand-up comedy. And I thought, it looks easy. It's only a few hours a week. Sounds great. And it wasn't easy because every week you had to get up and talk to a room full of people and just like pretty much get on it straight away. And I hadn't realized how terrifying that was. But I did the very first gig, even though it was in front of friends and, you know, other students. And I felt like I was going to be sick. But from that first laugh I got, I was like, this is the best thing I've ever done. It just immediately made you feel invincible. And then I never really looked back for sort of, gigging for about 20 years all over the world. And it's a very gratifying job. You know, I think you instantly know if people like you or not. They normally decide within about 30 seconds. And the feeling of if they like you and they laugh is, it's amazing, you know.
I'd say it's an unusual type of high that you get.
Yes.
Being on stage, people laughing at everything you're saying.
It is, but it's why. So I am absolutely not a thrill seeker in any other aspect of life. I can't deal with heights. I couldn't do any kind of like mega zip line or bungee jump or ultra marathon or even a marathon. I don't know why I said ultra marathon. I couldn't do a marathon. So for me, comedy's like, that's it. That's my hit. And even so, as I say, you know, I mentioned to you before we record, I'm not really doing very much performance anymore. I don't feel I need it so much. But there was a point where if I hadn't gigged for a week, I'd start getting quite itchy. Like I need to, I need to go and shout at people in a dark room, people I don't know. It's like a strange need. And I think a lot of comedians talk about it as like a compulsion. It's, you know, from the very first gig you do, whether you ever want to do it again or not, even if that gig is terrible. You might go on stage and bomb and everyone boo and throw things at you and leave. And if you want to do comedy again, you'll know in your head, oh, no, it'll work better next time, or not. And it's weird. It's just something that some people have, I think.
It's kind of, it's in your blood almost, in your DNA. Has there ever been a time where you haven't got on stage and it has, as you said yourself, been a bomb and people aren't laughing and you're thinking,
yeah.
Oh gosh, like what do I do here? How do I react? Like, has that happened to you before?
Like loads of times, absolutely loads of times. Yeah. I don't know a single comedian that hasn't had that happen to them. I think it's a real bonding thing in the comedy community in that we've all died on stage. That's what you call it, dying on stage. We've all had it. We've all had it for reasons we know why and reasons we don't know why. I think what's weird is a lot of people say, what's the best gig you've ever done? And I couldn't tell you. I could tell you the five worst gigs I've ever had because they will stay in my memory for the rest of my life. And there's one I always talk about, which I feel like this is unfairly tarring this place now. But there is a Blackwood Miners Institute in the middle of Wales, which I'd been there before and had a lovely time. But on this one instance, I got introduced to the stage and got no applause. I walked on stage and they stared at me. And for 30 minutes, because I had to do my time to get paid, they just did absolute silence. And I tried stories and I tried jokes. And I tried talking to them. I tried improvising and I got nothing for 30 minutes. And then I said, thank you, and walked off stage to silence. And I still have no idea to this day what I did wrong. But I got in my car and just drove as fast as I could out of there. I was going, I am gone. I am never coming back. That's me done. Yeah.
30 minutes sounds like an extremely long period of time if you're standing on stage and nobody's reacting.
It felt like an eternity. What made it worse is just before I left, I saw the next act get on stage and storm it. He absolutely stormed it. Lots of laughs, lots of applause. So, you know, but these things happen. I mainly enjoy telling the story now. I don't think it probably has scarred me for life, to be fair. But, you know, these things happen to all of us. Every comedian has horror stories. We've all dealt, you know, you don't know what you're dealing with until you get on that stage. A room can seem nice and suddenly turn. A room can seem rowdy and suddenly be attentive. And you become a really good judge of people. Like, it's really weird that you can. There was a point, especially about 10 years in, where I could go into any room and immediately go, okay, I know exactly who here's relaxed. I know exactly who's paying attention, exactly where I need to direct this bit to, exactly where I need to direct this bit to. And it becomes almost unconscious, an unconscious decision. You're just kind of aware of it all. It's very strange.
And would something like that kind of be developed just by the repetition of you doing so many shows over time?
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit like, I'm sure, you know, exactly with what you do and with what everyone does in that you do it a lot and it becomes second nature. It becomes the thing that you know how to do. And the best thing you can do as a comedian, or as probably with any job, is just do it lots. And the more you gig, the more you become aware of yourself on stage and how you talk and what you like to talk about and how the rhythms of your voice work and how jokes bounce. And there was a point where to write a joke, I'd sit and I'd craft it. And now I generally just think, what do I want to talk about? Oh, that, here's three jokes. And it's just sort of, it comes to you quite easily. Not always. That sounds like a real boast. There are times when it still doesn't at all, but generally, I know who I am and what my voice is. And that makes it a lot easier, I think.
Was there any time, Tiernan, where, and I'm trying to kind of put myself in your position of, you've just got into the car, 30 minutes of stand on stage, nobody's laughing. You're trying improvisation, you're trying jokes, you're trying everything, stories, all these different tactics that you have up your sleeve, obviously. Is there any element of self-doubt creeping in during a time like that? Because even something you said in the talk that I watched yesterday was the fact that generally being a comic would be considered an unconventional sort of job. And it's not something that a lot of people do or even do well, I would imagine. Like, was there any period of time where there was self-doubt kind of creeping into your mind, thinking, like, can I do this thing or should I do this thing? And particularly after a difficult show like that. Or was it just something that you absolutely knew you could do?
No. Self-doubt all the time and throughout. And after the phrase that comics would use is you're only as good as your last gig. And so when your last gig's bad, you particularly worry and stress, and you just have to, I don't know. I mean, again, with time, I got better at it. There were definitely loads. There were many, many years where I would blame myself for everything going wrong, and I would worry about it and think, well, that's the end of this. I've got to do something else. And then you get on stage next night, storm it, and go, oh, no, it's fine. It's all right. And you just have to kind of encourage yourself to get back up and go again. But I think, I've got self-doubt all the time. I think I'm openly confident, but in reality, I've got a lot of worry. I regularly, my wife gets a regular kind of counseling session. We go, is this good? Is this funny? Does this work? Do you think this is a good idea? And she regularly has to go, yes, no, stop it, whatever. I'm very pleased I've got her there as a sounding board. But unless I know for a fact that I've got a laugh at it there and then, or in the case of like a lot of my writing now, unless I've got notes back going, that's funny, and I know I need to know, I still need that gratification before I'm happy, before I feel any confidence. And then it's gone again as soon as I have to do something else. So, there's a lot of doubt, I think. You just become hardened to it, and you become hardened to, I think you become very good at reasoning when it's not worth having the doubt over. You know, like a lot of people sort of worry about comedy hecklers, and there comes a real point, well, which I should say for a start, doesn't happen as often as people think it does. And often it is just drunk people thinking they should shout out. And you learn after a while that it's not personal. They would have shouted out at anyone, and often they do. And, that's not your fault, or kind of abuse on the internet for a joke that someone doesn't like. You realize it's not you. There's 40 people that did like it. There's 100 people that did like it. It's, you just become very good at reasoning when you should take the criticism and when you shouldn't, I think.
Mm. I'm always fascinated by like somebody's thought process around something, and particularly like a difficult or challenging time. And I would imagine if you're only as good as your last show, there's probably a very large proportion of comics that do quit and that do give up and that do let the self-doubt creep in too heavily and kind of influence them out of following that career path. Why do you feel you didn't? Why do you feel you're somebody who even though, as you said, admittedly, you kind of have this self-doubt, am I funny, am I not? Am I funny, am I not? Why have you been so consistent?
I think there's a thin line between stupidity and bravery, isn't there? I'm not sure which side. It must be stupidity. I don't know. I've always been... I'm terrible at doing like normal jobs. I was really bad in an office. I was really annoying. I just bothered everyone else with jokes and ideas and emailed them things, like just annoying sketch ideas that I had all day. I would get my work done and then distract everyone else. And I had managers that would be very upset with me. And I had it when I was like a waiter, I'd always just leave notes for the other members of staff and talk to tables for too long. And I think I've always known where my strengths are. And I think also, I suppose more selfishly, it's what I wanted to do. I always just thought, no, I like traveling. I like entertaining. I don't enjoy so much other work. Why should I kind of, why should I do that when I can keep pushing forward? I know I can get things better. There is that confidence comes through there. I think at this weird, I don't know where that is from actually, but a weird reassurance that somehow I can fix bits that don't work and get there. I think I was lucky, as I said. I think my first few gigs were they were among friends at university, and that was quite an easy way. And I know a lot of stand-ups who would just stand up at an open mic gig for like for the first time and just go for it, and would have a much rougher experience. And I think having laughs straight off the bat was very helpful. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a really good question, actually. I don't really know. I know a lot of people that have quit, and I think it's not an easy job as well, not just because of that you're yourself on stage and that's a very open thing to do, but also because it's a lot of traveling and it's very late nights, and it's not particularly good for your diet eating after gigs and all that. There's often a lot of alcohol involved, although that's much less so nowadays, thankfully. You know, there's a lot of aspects to it that aren't easy as well, I think, compared to normal working hours that make it quite a tough job to do.
It sounds as if it's like a bit of an emotional roller coaster, even just physically getting on stage and thinking like, is this going to be successful? Is it going to bomb? As you say, are people going to laugh? Are they not? And even from my own perspective, like speaking to a group of people can make you quite nervous and can almost inevitably cause adrenaline to surge in your system. Do you, or have you noticed much changes or many changes with blood sugars when you're physically performing? Like, do you see an impact on your blood sugar, or how does that look?
Well, it's really interesting you say it. So these things that I suppose, you know, I know you spoke to one of your recent guests about technology and diabetes. And I think before I had constant monitoring, I didn't really have any clue how it was affecting me. And constant glucose monitoring helped my doctor realize that every time I went on stage, my sugars would rise for about 2 hours and then fall for about 2 hours. And it would be the case every time. It would happen about 15 minutes before I walked on stage. There would be a sudden rise, and it wouldn't go massive. It would maybe go to like a 12, you know, it would go a good few points above whatever I was. And then that would last no matter what I did until about 2 hours when the adrenaline came down. And my doctor tried things like do insulin before the gig, and I did it and then went low on stage and had an awful time. And, you know, it's like there's nothing. There came a point where I tried so many things. I had a sort of, I raised the basal during the background, and none of it made a difference. And I ended up just going, it's just for 4 hours. I'll just do it. You know, whatever it was, I just had to kind of get on with it. But it's also something that had been happening to me for years. I would have been affecting my HbA1 and all these things. And I didn't have a clue because I didn't have the constant glucose monitoring. And of course, I couldn't do a blood test while I was on stage. I had no idea. What, you can't really sort of just go, excuse me, everyone. If we can just pause that joke right there while I get my kit out and, you know, prick my finger. You can't do that. So I never had a clue exactly how it was affecting me. And I also probably wouldn't have done one just before I ran on stage because your mind's in a different, but I would have done at least half an hour to an hour before and then a little while after, you know. So it's made a really big difference that to see exactly what these adrenaline rushes do. And yeah, I think it sort of explained quite a lot to me, really, as well. It was really handy to know that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I used to get it when, obviously not standing up trying to make people laugh, but before, for example, like a big football match where like the adrenaline is high and you're feeling nervous and you know that this is an important thing that you need to do, it just vroom, skyrocket. And then almost inevitably every time come back down when the adrenaline has kind of settled. Was there any time that you did have to stop throughout a show, or was there any time that diabetes like got in the way of the thing that you wanted to do?
No, not really. I was always quite stubborn about just sort of pushing, because I think so. Most comedy sets are normally about 20 minutes. I think at most, you know, normally if you're doing a comedy club, be about 20 minutes. Sometimes it'd be 30. When I was doing the Edinburgh Fringe, I'd do an hour. And, you know, but when sort of times when I'd been going low on stage, I'd sort of always think, well, I've got 6 minutes left. Let's just get to the end and then I'll fix it. You know,
hold on.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure, I don't know how you are when you go low. I'm quite irrational. When I go low, my brain's just like, you can do this. You'll be fine. Even though clearly not. And it's taken me years to work out, no, shut up. You know, when you have to tell your own brain to shut up because you're like, no, you're going low. You haven't got a clue. And I think in the middle of being on stage when my mind's already on lots of material, it was just like, power through it. You'll be fine. And of course, I'd come on stage and check and go, oh, I'm a two. Oh, no. And it would sort of hit you like a sort of eat a load of jelly babies. That's, I mean, you know, the difference, I suppose you did football. I guess the running around in a match, that must have leveled you out a bit, whereas I was kind of just on a stage and it's not as much movement. So yeah. You don't get that chance to for it to bring you back down, unfortunately.
You're hitting the nail on the head saying like that kind of irrational thought process that you can go through. And I went through not a great phase of when I was doing, say, like, let's say a longer distance run. And if I was coming to the end of the run, I knew inevitably at some stage my bloods would start trending lower, as they would do. I went through a period where I was so into the run that even if I knew my blood sugars were coming down, I'd be like, just keep going, another 1 or 2K, which is just like not a measured or healthy decision to make. But if you're already kind of low, your brain's not functioning as is anyway. So not ideal.
Yeah, low brain is a really weird state of mind. I really think it sort of always reminded me of, like, say, if you're a bit drunk and you're like, I can get home. I definitely can get home. You know, and you sort of decide you're
just gonna run home.
Like, yeah, that's it. I can run home. It's not that far and it'll be miles or whatever. You know, it's that sort of slightly irrational mind that is way too confident. And yeah, again, I think it took me way too long to realize, you know, to almost be aware of that and talk the irrational mind round. It's such a tricky state of affairs. And it's the same, I think, when I go high, I'm now very aware. I can't write when I'm high. If my sugars are too high, I cannot be creative. It really, like, it's like there's a real block on it. I'm too spaced out to come up with any jokes. It's really weird. So I have to just constantly go, okay, wait till they come. Stop trying to write this joke that is not going to happen until these sugars come down. It's weird. It's really odd.
There's the incentive to improve diabetes management over time. try to write jokes.
Yeah.
Well, Tiernan, what's, for yourself and your own experience, what's a challenging aspect of comedy that us normal people wouldn't have any clue about? That's kind of behind the scenes, that is a really difficult aspect of it that we would never see or be aware of.
That's very interesting.
That was part one of this episode. If you are listening to this on the day of the release, part two will be out tomorrow. But if you're listening on any other day, part two is the next episode on our list.